Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Slate Money is sponsored by Citrix GoToMeeting. When meetings matter, millions choose GoToMeeting. Hold a meeting with anyone from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet, and get a free 30-day trial by visiting GoToMeeting.com and clicking the Try It Free button.
Hello, and welcome to the Money for Nothing edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion, and I'm joined, as always, by Cathy O'Neill, the data scientist and blogger at mathbabe.org.
Hi, Felix.
Hi, Cathy. And also Slate's Money Box columnist, Jordan Weissman.
Happy to be here with you two lovely people.
This week, we are going to talk about the music industry and the recording artists who are taking some unusual approaches to how they get paid for what they do. We are also going to take a look at how a 20-something investor sparked a plunge in the share price of Lumber Liquidators. And as we hinted at last year, I wouldn't say promised because I try not to make promises, I break them too much. We will talk a little bit more about the wonderful subject of patent trolls. So I think that we should start with music, because music makes everybody happy.
It does. Well, I want to start off. Felix, are you a fan of the Wu-Tang?
I like a fair amount of Wu-Tang. The interesting thing about Wu-Tang is they have roughly twice as large a vocabulary as any other rap group in the world. They really spit awesome.
They spit fire. Kathy, are you down with the Wu? Are you a killer bee?
I learned about this week. I listened to my first Wu-Tang Clan song this morning. So I would not say I'm a fan, but I enjoyed the song.
So I'm not a Wu-Tang obsessive, but I think like most 20-something nerds, I do have love for the Wu-Tang. Who, for those who don't know, they are one of the essential 90s rap groups, and they continued making great music up through the last decade. Anyway, why are they in the news? Well, Wu-Tang is producing its last album, or so they say.
Last ever?
Last ever. That's what they say this is. It's called Once a Time in Shaolin. However, this isn't your typical album. This isn't your typical album sale. What they've done is they've created this piece of music, and they say they are pressing a single copy.
Well, they have pressed a single copy.
And they did this over a year ago. And they've supposedly destroyed all of the other digital versions. There is nothing but this one hard copy left, and they are planning to sell it like a piece of fine art to a bidder.
They put out a press release about a year ago explaining what the hell they were doing, where they were saying, we want our art to be valued like that of Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Yes. Wait
a second. Felix, you're the art snob among us. To what extent is an album put out by a music group anything like fine art?
Very, very little is the answer, Kathy, because there's a couple of like key issues here. Number one, if they want to be valued like Jean-Michel Basquiat, one of the key things that Jean-Michel Basquiat did in order to become valuable was die.
Are they willing to die, Jordan?
Are they willing to die for their art?
Sadly, Old Dirty Bastard is no longer with us. So one of the members is gone.
And yet he was also not on this album. The other thing that Jean-Michel Basquiat did was he made, you know, objects which are not only unique, but are unique for a reason. You can't just sort of press a button and copy them. Whereas music, and especially this kind of music, but all music really, is a fundamentally collective experience. For all that we listen to music, you know, individually on headphones on the subway, you know, it's about everyone knowing the songs. It's about having a shared experience. It's about sharing your Spotify playlist. It's about going to concerts where everyone is listening to the same thing at the same time in a live experience. And the idea of just gratuitously getting rid of all of that for the sake of some half-baked idea about value is insane.
So I disagree with you on a lot of fronts here. But there's a lot going on. It's going to take a little while to unpack. First, I think since we are Slate Money, I want to address the financial end of this, which is, you know, you have to remember we're talking about a very specific group, the Wu-Tang Clan. They are essentially now they're not a cult act. They've got a much bigger fan base than that. But they're an older rap group that doesn't do a ton in sales. I think their last album, when it came out, had about 27,000 in its first week. They don't put up big numbers anymore. I have a hunch, however, they do have an incredibly obsessive fan base. I have a hunch that they might be able to make more money doing this if they can just get two very wealthy rap nerds to essentially bid against each other.
Do you think they're doing it for the money, though?
No, I think that I'm starting off with my, I don't think it's for the
okay.
money. The second part is, I agree with Felix that the direct comparison to the art world is a little bit weird and slightly confused. Some of the background here is hip-hop in general has kind of developed this fascination with high art and high culture, and I think some of that is sort of natural. Rap has always sort of been about status amongst, you know, MCs and whatnot, but also versus the larger culture, right? And as some of these guys have gotten more successful and more rich, they're not just, you know, guys like Jay-Z aren't just comparing themselves to other people in the music industry. They're comparing themselves mentally to the great geniuses, great artists that their new peer group kind of like to talk about, like Warhol or whatnot. And so you literally see references to things like Warhol, to people like Warhol or Basquiat coming up more frequently in rap albums themselves now. And you can look at the data on Genius and see that. And, you know, Jay-Z himself did this whole performance with Maria Abramovich a while ago where he was doing Picasso Baby live. And so there's been this kind of growing intersection between rap and high art, for better or worse. I don't think that selling and the reason we're talking about this week is the album was being hit, by the way, was hidden off in Morocco somewhere in a special nickel-plated box that had been carved by an artisan, and they just brought it overseas. They previewed some of it at MoMA PS1 for journalists to hear, and apparently the sale is getting going in earnest. But I don't think it's like a painting. However, Wu-Tang has this weird sort of philosophy / mythology or shtick, whatever you want to call it. And there was this thing that Raekwon, one of the rappers, said that I thought was interesting. He said, owning this will be like owning the scepter of a pharaoh. And I think that's more what this is. It's owning a relic. It's owning, I have the one copy of the last album that will ever be made by these people, supposedly. And to a certain kind of person, that has, I think, value. They're trying to create value there the same way it almost would in antiquity. So I think culturally there's something interesting.
Okay, so the first thing which I need to jump in here and say is, if you buy this and they want a seven-figure sum, it's not clear how much they're asking, it's not clear why they have managed to go a year without even coming close to selling it. But if you buy it, you have every right to just torrent it. You are allowed to give it away to the world. And I have a reasonable expectation that that's exactly what is going to end up happening. Because music is it has what's known as positive externalities. The value of your album, you know, it becomes a better album. It becomes part of the cultural discourse if everybody knows it, if everybody knows what it's like. If I owned it and I wanted everyone to, you know, and I liked it, I would want everyone to be able to hear it and I would give it away. I can't imagine why someone would buy it and then not do that.
Well, I think it is for that sort of like cult value, saying I have, like some buyers. However, I did talk to Paddle 8, the dealers, and they told me something interesting yesterday that hasn't really been covered too much. There's been some mention of it, which is that it seems like they're actually interested in selling to either a, quote, institutional buyer or someone who will give it to an institutional buyer, which usually means a museum. So there is one other potential option here that I see the way that this could unfold, which would be kind of cool in my opinion, which is you might just get a buyer with more money than necessarily sense, who sort of like there's a Rothko temple in Houston, you could end up with a Wu-Tang temple somewhere in Staten Island or something, or like in New York. And so I think that does open up interesting possibilities for what could be done with it beyond just a guy buying it and keeping it at home or just torrenting it because he wants the whole world to hear. There might be some middle ground that could be fun.
I have a bluegrass band, and I'm going to go with Felix on saying that it doesn't make sense to do music by yourself. Although, one hesitation is that, you know, you go to these really fancy bar mitzvahs in New York and they get, you know, singers to come sing live concerts to the bar mitzvah. That is status, right? If you get a famous singer. But I was going to say that I am happy to make a rip a CD of our songs and sell it for millions of dollars for my bluegrass band. Anybody who wants to buy it. I guess my point is this really a new model of the music industry?
No. I don't think anyone is going to try and replicate this. This is a bizarre sort of one-off stunt. And we're going to talk in a second about Amanda Palmer, which she has a new model which is much more replicable and it's based on something similar.
That I agree with.
But before... before we do that, I think it's worth also just briefly bringing up this guy, Peter Lick, who's a photographer based in Las Vegas, who just sold or claims to have sold a unique photograph, which is a truly atrocious photograph.
It's awful. Like, it's truly
awful. For $6.5 million. Now, no one knows really who the buyer was or whether it was actually sold for $6.5 million. But the point is that, especially in a place like Las Vegas, all manner of weird shit happens. And so it's possible that the Wu-Tang Clan will find one person. And this is the thing. You don't even need an underbidder. You don't even need two people who are willing to pay, you know, $2 million for this thing. All you need is one. And the clan to just be very smart in the way they negotiate and say, you can have this for $2 million. And there might be one person out there who will do that. You know, and when we get to the end of the show with my number... we might have a hint of who that one person might be.
It doesn't seem $2 million would even recover their costs of making this, not to mention the nickel-plated box.
The nickel-plated box cost nothing.
But it was apparently hand-carved by a Moroccan artist in Marrakesh with 13 assistants or something. Again, they're very into numbers. It's all part, and that's, so they're also, there's a, again, this clause in the deal that you can't sell it. You're not allowed to release it commercially for 88 years if you purchase this thing, but you are allowed to give it away for free, that is.
This clause and, about not being able to release it commercially is a bit of a red herring. No one is going to buy it and say, well, I'm going to buy it and then release it commercially and make money off it.
That would clearly not be an option. Ruin the point of buying this thing. I mean, that would be the absolute worst way to go about it. But anyway, so yes, you have a cult act that has looking for one obsessive fan to buy, essentially. Right. Let's go to the flip side of a cult act who's looking for lots of obsessive fans.
Well, not lots, like somewhere in the region of a couple of thousand.
Are we talking about Amanda Palmer right now?
We're talking about Amanda Palmer.
So Amanda Palmer, for those just a little background who don't know her, is a... pretty well-known artist now. She got her start in the early 2000s with a band called the Dresden Dolls that described themselves as a Brechtian cabaret punk act. And then she went solo in 2008. Singer, songwriter, pianist has done some... she's done some good stuff. Felix, I believe, is a fan. And she does have this very dedicated...
Felix, what do you know about Amanda?
Very dedicated...
I know Amanda pretty well, and I really love the Dresden Dolls, and I am absolutely fascinated by... the way that she has tried to create a sustainable business model out of having a very fervent but not particularly enormous fan base.
And so that brings us to the news about her this week, which is that there's this new service called Patreon, which essentially it's sort of like, it's a bit like Kickstarter. The idea is that an artist puts himself on there and tells their patrons that, or asks their patrons to give them money, essentially, every time they produce a new work of art. So every time I create a new song, a new single, a new album, you'll give me X amount of money. I believe now Amanda Palmer has enough patrons or on Patreon to give her $14,000 every time she makes a new song now. Is that the number?
It's higher than that now.
I mean, it's so she's making, I mean, a real go of it on this platform and showing this is one option for a certain kind of indie artist. I would say specifically...
Basically, the key thing is you need something with zero marginal cost of production that you can give away the song for free. And that creates a whole bunch of opportunities in terms of the business model here. Because what Amanda did last time was she famously raised over $1 million on a Kickstarter for her last album. But one of the problems with that is that with the Kickstarter rewards, they were all sort of physical. They were stuff which needed to be made, books, albums, you know, sent out in the mail. It was a massive logistical mess. And what happened was the idea was that this would give her enough money to go on tour and then create a big album which would sell very well. Turns out that basically everyone who wanted to buy the album supported the Kickstarter, and then no one really bought it after the album came out. And so Amanda said, well, why try and put all of this effort into touring the world and really, really trying to sell, become like a mass art, you know, a mass artist, when that's really not who I am. I have a small and fervent fan base. I should just make stuff for them. And she can, and she's found this way of doing it where she can actually make good money from that.
So I actually, it might not surprise you to hear that I've known Amanda Palmer since she was 12, because she went to Lexington public schools like I did. And I actually met her when she was 12. She was always a very remarkable young lady. Very remarkable.
Is that a euphemism?
I mean, she stood out. She looked like a grown up. You know, she, remember Taxi Driver, that movie? She, you know, she really looked like Jodie Foster.
Wow. That's something.
And then I sort of bumped into her a bunch of times as the Ice Princess in Harvard Square. You know, she was a performance artist. She actually dated the guy that lived in my parents' basement, who introduced her to German techno. Anyway, my point is that she has this incredible draw for some people. And that is, I would call her basically a cult leader. And, you know, not necessarily in a bad way. But I'm just wondering, you know, this new model that she has, is that only going to work for people that have a kind of a cult leader quality?
I don't know. Because
not all artists do that.
I mean, it's pretty hard for, it's never been easy for indie artists to make a living, you know, long into their careers. And the successful ones do tend to have what we call a cult audience. I don't think they quite need to have the same personal connection.
But
with,
also,
Amanda Palmer has,
this isn't an exclusive thing. Yeah, it's not either you follow the Amanda Palmer model or you follow the existing model of just touring all the time and blah, blah, blah. It's something which can be used to augment your income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can if you're a band or an artist, of, you know, a musical artist of any description, really, you can
do both.
Just keep on doing exactly what you're doing, but also have the Patreon income, you know, in addition. It's purely additional. It's purely extra money. That's good.
Yeah, I think there is this weird tension or this weird kind of dissonance about among music fans right now, no pun intended. But a lot of them don't want to pay for music, clearly. They want to stream it for free. At the same, they want as much variety as possible, and deciding to pay for music limits the amount of things you can listen to. At the same time, they really do like the idea of supporting, some of them really, really do like the idea of supporting artists. And those are often the same people. The ones who want to be able to consume as much music as possible and stream everything are the same people who really care about it. And so this is a way of resolving that in a way. It's saying, okay, well, I'm going to stream everything. And so it doesn't really make sense for me to buy albums. But at the same time, I can still directly support a few artists who I really like.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the one thing which you do need to do if you do the Patreon model, I'm pretty sure, is be very enthusiastic about giving your music away for free. It's not like the Patreon backers get a piece of music which no one else can get. That music is going to be out on YouTube. It's going to be out on Bandcamp, it's going to be out on SoundCloud, and people are going to be able to stream it on Spotify and do everything else which they like to do in the sort of free music world.
So it's in some sense like an advance tip, like you're tipping people for the stuff they've made, but you're tipping them in advance for whatever they're about to make.
Right, and it's giving them an economic incentive to make more stuff, and that's exactly what you want them to do.
They know it's coming.
You're paying for future work rather than past work, and I kind of like that model.
Yeah, it's cool. It says, I know. You're basically on contract at that point. You've patronage, you know? Anyway.
That's probably more than anyone ever wanted to hear on the music industry. Maybe one day we'll have Bob Lefsetz on and have more, but I think we've maybe done music for the time being. What we are going to move on to now is the very, very exciting part of the Slate Money podcast, where Kathy and Jordan are going to explain why, when it's freezing cold outside, what you need to do is, well, what do you need to do, Kathy?
I think you need to meet your clients and coworkers online with Citrix GoToMeeting, because it's the smarter way to meet.
Is that why we are happy to have Citrix GoToMeeting as our sponsor of Slate Money?
We're very happy about that, especially on these days of long snow days where you're just like, maybe your kid's school is going to get canceled. You don't know, but you don't want to cancel all those important meetings and lose the momentum you have on your project.
I think if nothing else, the last couple of weeks have shown the value of Citrix GoToMeeting. We've been blanketed in snow, and it has been very hard to get business done.
You know, I'd like to talk a little bit more about it. GoToMeeting makes it easy to meet with your team whenever you need to, wherever you are. With GoToMeeting, you can meet from any computer or mobile device without travel expenses or hassles of traffic or snow days. You can turn on your webcam, and with HD quality, it's like being in the same room. Everyone sees what you're seeing, so your team can get on the same page and get going. So try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting.com and click the Try It Free button. That's GoToMeeting.com and click the Try It Free button.
Kathy.
Yes.
Talking of good ideas,
yeah.
Is shorting stock in Lumber Liquidators a good idea?
You know, it was a little while ago. It's always scary to say you should do something on the stock market that was a good idea yesterday. But let me explain the backstory a little bit. So Lumber Liquidators got into the spotlight recently on a 60 Minutes episode, but the story actually starts a year before that. In June 20th of 2013, there was this guy named Zhuhua Zhao, who was born and raised in China, published a post on Seeking Alpha explaining that Lumber Liquidators were sort of using low-quality lumber from China with extra doses of formaldehyde.
Now, formaldehyde, we have to explain here, is something... When you buy cheap flooring rather than the expensive hardwood flooring, what you're basically buying is a bunch of bits of wood glued together rather than a piece of wood.
Right.
And the glue, if it's cheap glue, contains large amounts of formaldehyde.
Right.
And formaldehyde is bad for you.
It's a carcinogen. Yeah. And it also gives you all sorts of problems breathing, especially children. So it's a bad idea to have, like, to have flooring that has lots of formaldehyde. Now, there's lots of details about this. If you go to the 60 Minutes episode, which I highly recommend you do, they do all sorts of tests, and then they talk to the CEO of Lumber Liquidators, and Lumber Liquidators CEO, or at least the representative, says, well, you know, we test it differently, and according to our test, all this lumber passes the test, and you guys are testing it wrong. But then, you know, there's all sorts of reasons to think that they might be exaggerating that. Both Zhao and the 60 Minutes reporters did a bunch of tests, and they found things like six, on average, the lumber they got that was from China was six times higher in formaldehyde than it was allowed by California law.
Now, so this is the other thing which is making this short bet, because of course there are lots of short sellers here because Lumber Liquidators is a public company. This is one of the things which is making the short bet quite lucrative, is that while there's not much in the way of regulations about how much formaldehyde you can have in your flooring, there is an exception to that rule, and that exception is California. And so everything which Lumber Liquidators sells, they should try and make sure that it lives up to California standards, because A, they sell a lot in California, and B, those California standards are probably going to wind up being rolled out to the rest of the country. But so the only real regulations here which matter are the California regulations.
That's interesting. I didn't even know that. But they did test after the 60 Minutes thing went up. Like, there's been further tests, and they've been finding that, yes, in fact, it's all over the country they have these problems with formaldehyde.
So, you know, the part about this story that interests me is that, again, it started with this 25-year-old kid, essentially. You know,
he was in a doctoral program at UCLA in finance. He quit.
He's as much of a kid as I am, if not less of a kid. Let's be real.
He basically is like, what am I doing in a doctoral program when I could just be making money on the market?
Let me amend that.
And
with a 25-year-old genius one person who decided that he was going to start researching this and just hunting down these details and figuring out what was going on at Lumber Liquidators.
Yeah.
And again, what I find fascinating about this is, for a good short seller, what motivates them in the end is basically the same impulse that motivates like a good investigative journalist, right? It's the same idea of just like finding a company where something shady going on, where you can expose that they've been bullshitting you.
Yep.
They've been bullshitting the market.
So yeah, short sellers and investigative journalists have always been best friends. You know, Enron was basically the product, or the end of Enron was a product of one of those short seller investigative journalist unions, as have many other things. The techniques are very similar.
So why do short sellers get the bad rap? Because even in the 60 Minutes episode, you know, the guy at representing the Lumber Liquidators was like, oh, there's just a bunch of short sellers saying this stuff.
For some reason, short selling is considered un-American in some way. And so if you are a short seller, especially if you're an aggressive short seller who's accusing a company of being fraudulent, there's a very good chance that you will wind up having SEC investigations against you and stuff like that, because somehow the financial establishment has never really taken short sellers as a good thing. They think it's a bad thing.
Right. It's bad news that you don't want to hear. It's kind of like your friends are getting divorced and you're like, oh my God, that must mean your marriage is bad, but they just don't want to hear it. So they tell you not
and
to get
divorced. And then I don't know if you remember during the financial crisis.
Yes.
They actually banned short selling this long list of financial companies because it was considered to be such a bad thing. Whereas, in fact, what short selling does is it basically just enables price discovery.
So in retrospect, and that's exactly what I was going to bring up, Felix. In retrospect, those bans on short selling of financial companies like banks it was a purely political ploy, and it didn't, you know, what they were attempting to do was convince the market that these banks weren't so bad. But
okay,
they really were.
So here's the irony is that these bans were put in by very sophisticated people like Hank Paulson, who knew exactly why short selling is a good thing, and they were put in despite everyone knowing that short selling is a good thing. And here's the crazy thing. They actually worked.
Yep.
The short term.
Yes. But that was all you needed.
Well, wasn't the idea...
So explain that.
What we had was a panic situation in the market where everyone wanted to get out at the same time. And the way you make money from a panic is by short selling stocks and then making a profit when they fall. And short selling stocks itself helps contribute to the panic. And no one really knows in these situations what the fair value of a company is. All they're doing is they're playing the momentum, and the momentum is downwards. By putting a ban on short selling in, what you do is you make it much harder to monetize panic. And if it's harder to monetize panic and harder to create a panic, then you're less likely to have a panic. And if you don't have a panic, then everyone is better off.
I mean, I have a different view, which is that, it interrupted the downward spiral. But a lot of these companies were essentially bankrupt. So maybe they should have gone down, you know?
Well, no. Actually, if you look at the list of stocks which where the short selling was banned, most of them came through, like, once the ban was put in place... You know, and then fast forward, you know, a year or two to see what the fair value turned out to be. It was higher than where the ban was put in place.
There's a Fed study that came out that said that short selling bans actually don't work. And they looked at maybe they weren't thinking very short term like we're talking about, but they were looking at like the ones in France and Spain. Short selling bans happened all over the place during the crisis.
Well, I think then doesn't that speak to sort of you have to be very careful about the lesson of what went on during the financial crisis or this specific move by Hank Paulson and whatnot, like that this was a particular moment where there was a contagion going on. And so it might have worked right there for this brief spark, but it's not something to repeat every time a company looks like it's in trouble.
Certainly, there's no point in putting a ban on short selling something like Lumber Liquidators.
Yeah, I was going to bring back to that. Yeah.
And the, you know, and what we're seeing here, for instance, what the 60 Minutes journalists did, which was fantastic, was they actually sent a bunch of undercover reporters to China to the companies which were making Lumber Liquidators flooring, and they got people on the record saying, yeah, we're labeling these things as compliant with California regulations, but they're not. If you want them to actually be compliant with the California regulations, you're going to have to pay much more money for them.
It's amazing.
It was pretty smoking gun.
It's amazing that Chinese factories haven't figured out like a series of euphemisms for like we are grossly violating.
I love that guy. whoever that guy is. Thank you for saying that.
But there is a big business now, as the Chinese stock market has exploded and as China as an industrial and manufacturing base has exploded and the number of Chinese billionaires has exploded. There's a lot of very dodgy stuff going on in China. It's really Wild West. And a few people have realized that there's a lot of money to be made exposing the dodgy stuff in China.
And good for them. I want them to do it.
So, yeah, good for them. And so... from cheering on the short sellers, which is something I'm always happy to do as a journalist, we are going to move on to the topic which we were talking about a little bit last week, which is patent trolls. Kathy, your number last week was the amount of money that a patent troll had managed to get awarded from Apple. It was over $500 million. And we got a bunch of interesting feedback, including a long email from a patent lawyer in Australia who was trying to defend this practice. And we're saying, but, you know, this is just capitalism, that you buy and sell intellectual property, and that it's very important that you can protect your intellectual property. Otherwise, you won't be able to make any money. And there's a reason for patents. And if there's a reason for patents, they ought to be traded. And if they can be traded, they ought to be litigable. And what's wrong here?
Well, so I think I have a good way to describe what actually is a big part of what's gone wrong in the whole world of patents, which is there are just like really bad patents being issued. I mean, just really low quality patents being issued that probably should never have been issued in the first place. But I call this sort of the fortune cookie theory of patent law. And you know the old joke with the fortune cookie, just put in bed at the end of every sentence and it makes a joke out of it. Like, you'll have great fortune in bed. Keep your enemies close, your friends close, and your enemies closer in bed. Ha ha ha. Well, for a while, patent law practically worked the same way, except it was on the internet. They would say you would take a very normal business practice, like credit card transaction, or putting something in a cart, buying something and putting it in another part of the site, or putting it in a digital shopping cart, but that just say on the internet, and suddenly you had a patent. And so they just let all these people patent these extremely broad concepts that were really fundamental to anybody doing any kind of reasonable e-commerce. And so it led to patent trolls getting a hold of these low-quality patents, stocking them up, and then essentially, I mean, I would say mugging corporate America and companies that are doing real innovation through these patent litigation firms, these patent trolls, just kind of pulling a little bit of money off of companies.
And it wasn't even a little bit of money.
A lot of money.
Yeah. You know, people that sort of received wisdom these days is that the invention of the iPhone was what was responsible for killing the BlackBerry. But really what was responsible for killing the BlackBerry was a lawsuit from a patent troll. And that lawsuit damaged Research in Motion, you know, BlackBerry's parent company, so badly that they essentially just went to zero.
Okay, I'm going to defend patents.
Go on.
Because somebody has to defend patents.
Well, I think it depends on the type of patent. Oh, okay,
I think, and I really enjoyed the emails from our listener in Australia, Rob McGuinness. He makes the really very convincing point that patents, we can go into this, but as patents as a rule is a pretty good system. There's obviously marginal problems with it. But the single biggest problem, Rob points out, is that it is too easy to sue people for patent infringement. And in particular, you don't take any risks.
In Texas, where there's like the one town in Texas where all the juries always seem to find in favor
of the
patent
Eastern
trolls.
District of Texas is known as the Rocket Docket.
Okay, so so in order to make this argument clean, I want us to define patent trolls.
Okay, that's so let me. I will do my best at defining patent trolls, and I'm going to define them quite broadly. It's quite easy to find one or two super egregious ones, and I can highly recommend listening to the This American Life episode on patent trolls, who found some very, very egregious ones. But I would basically just say that let's take the biggest granddaddy of them all. This company called Intellectual Ventures, which was founded by Nathan Myhrvold, who's a co-founder of Microsoft. And what Intellectual Ventures does is they get a bunch of really, really smart people in a room over and over and over again and have them come up with lots and lots of ideas. And then what they do is they go out and patent those ideas. And that's it. They don't try and make money off those ideas. They don't try to turn the ideas into products. Occasionally they'll find other people with good ideas and they'll buy the patents off them. But then they just sit on this huge patent portfolio, and then they ransom anyone who has the same idea. That someone else has the same idea, and they go, ah, you had that idea, but now, no, sorry, we have the patent on it, so you need to pay us $1 billion.
So there's also, I want to just offer the defense those kinds of patent trolls sometimes put up for themselves, which is that, well, we need to exist so that if a small inventor comes up with an idea who doesn't have the wherewithal to protect it himself, he can sell it to us and monetize it, and then we can protect it. It's not clear how often that ever really happens, that it's really they're helping the little guy. Most of the time, it's them buying or doing something like Intellectual Ventures or buying some cache of patents that have just been sitting around in a dusty corner somewhere.
So a patent troll is defined as some entity that collects patents and then basically scares people with
no intent to use
them. I would say a patent troll is an entity which makes substantially all of its money from litigating patents or threatening to litigate patents.
Yeah, I think that's
a fit. They don't have a real business. That is their business.
So look, now let's go to our listener Rob's point, which is that the threat to litigate patents is what it seems like the real problem with that patent troll industry. Namely, that because the person who threatens to litigate doesn't have to pay any consequences if they lose, they don't even have to pay the lawyer's fee for the other side of the people they're threatening. What often happens is when people are being threatened by patent trolls, they just say, okay, just take the money or I'll figure some other way of doing it. And so they never actually go to court. And what the problem with that is bad patents don't get discarded in court when they should be.
That's true.
And also, courts don't really have the ability to discard bad patents. This is another huge problem.
They do sometimes.
If you look at what happened in the case between in the RIM, Research in Motion, and their patent troll, the patent in question was clearly an atrocious patent. There was lots of prior art. It was way broad. It was crap. But the judge basically just said, no, this was awarded by the patent office. So long as it's in force, we have to assume that the patent is correct. And now we just litigate.
I would argue that's changing a bit. There was fairly last year, I believe, a case known as Alice Corp versus CLS Bank International, a Supreme Court decision that basically said that the fortune cookie rule I was talking about before won't work anymore. They said that...
But it's so much broader than that. You can't... Yes, there might be little bits about on the internet or whatever, but you know, the idea of a business process patent still exists, which is just, we invented a way of doing something, you know, or...
But also the Bilski case... Sorry, I'm not going to start naming off Supreme Court cases, but my general point is the Supreme Court is in its own gradual way beginning to step in and do what Congress hasn't and limit the scope of the kinds of things you can patent. And you're seeing judges respond by actually invalidating patents now more so than they were before these cases. So I think there has been some... There has been a little bit of shifting. But I do think also this point about the ease with which we can sue and the lack of consequences if you lose in court and just bring a frivolous suit that you get defeated on is a problem. And there has been some legislation suggested that or has been proposed to deal with that. Things like, you know, if you bring a patent suit, you essentially have to put a lot of money in escrow.
Right.
So it ties up your capital, so you can't just bring these suits in.
Right. Frivolous
in bulk.
Lawsuit seems like a big problem, but it's not actually a patent problem.
I mean, I think it's a patent problem and a frivolous lawsuit problem. Mm-hmm. And it's the way those two issues kind of marry each other and create
and
this really awful
there,
union.
There are also patent problems which are not patent troll problems. There's problems with the patent system which aren't just to do with patent trolls. And the big one is that if you want to do anything in technology, the way you create great ideas and create, you know, multi-billion dollar tech ideas in the tech space these days is not to invent something new. It's to take a whole bunch of stuff which already exists and put it together in an innovative and clever way.
Yeah.
And that is something which we should be encouraging, but that is something which is basically impossible unless you're one of a handful of multi-billion dollar companies with huge defensive patent portfolios.
Yeah.
Google, I don't know if you remember this, when they bought Motorola for $5 billion, they weren't buying any particular business. They were just buying the patent portfolio, and not because they wanted to monetize it directly, but just because they knew that Motorola had certain patents which were very valuable in theory. And that if anyone sued them, if any other big company tried to sue Google, Google could say, hey, that's not a good idea because we can sue you just as easily. And it becomes a defensive. And unless you have $5 billion and all of those patents in your back pocket, you basically aren't allowed to innovate.
I do agree that and I've heard from engineers that, you know, they spend way too much time thinking about patents and thinking about patenting every idea they have and sorting through the patents that they're using or bypassing. It occurs to me that maybe in certain fields, the patent system doesn't work as well. Like maybe it's like 20 years, right? Once you've patented something, you people have to pay you for it.
Yeah, this is the technology industry where like 20 years is forever.
Right.
It's well known that, for instance, there's no real point in even trying to get into the 3D printing space just because there's all of these crazy patents and patent trolls and patent big companies.
I mean, fundamentally, the problem with the U.S. patent system is it works very, very well for one very large vested interest, which is...
The pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah, pharmaceutical industry. Exactly.
Yes.
It works extremely well, and we could probably devote an entire episode to this subject, but the short version of it is because in order to develop pharmaceutical, you need takes a lot of money and a lot of lead-up time and a lot of failure. And so you need some guarantee you're going to be able to sell that drug for a long time.
And moreover, if we're going to name real problems, we can also name the way that the pharmaceutical company actually extends past those 20 years.
That's true. That's
by these sort of fake inventions.
Another whole issue altogether. But and also it's very particular. There's a molecule. Like, you can patent very particular.
It's
not an abstract idea. So the things that work very well for protecting the pharmaceutical industry and making it function somewhat work terribly for software, I think. And that is the big split here, is that we have one patent system for very disparate industries.
Yeah.
And so, well, I'm going to end by on a slightly hopeful note, which is this wonderful thing called the Open Invention Network, which has grown up out of the open source sort of Linux-based software world, where a bunch of big companies, including Google and other people like that, have signed on to this OIN and said, we are going to patent a bunch of ideas, but then we're just going to make them open for anyone to use. And if that expands, that would be amazing.
Yeah, it's basically cessation of the patent
war. It would be nice.
Let's move on to some numbers here, because we haven't had nearly enough numbers.
I have the nerdiest number. Can I go last?
Yes. Oh, you want to go last with your nerd number?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to go first. I'm going to call back an episode from quite a while ago that we had, this philanthropy episode with Rob Reich and Jesse Eisinger. And I really enjoyed recording that episode. And one of the things we talked about in that episode was the way that Lincoln Center had paid $15 million to the family of Avery Fisher, who had previously donated $10 million. So he kind of weirdly made a profit on his donation so that they could then rename the hall, which was Avery Fisher Hall. The other shoe finally dropped this week. In return for a $100 million donation, so this is my number, $100 million, David Geffen gets his name on the hall. So we are now going to be listening to music in David Geffen Hall from here on in perpetuity, because he's decided, because he's, I believe the technical term is an asshole, that he needs to have his name on the hall in perpetuity. So in perpetuity, we're going to be listening to music in David Geffen Hall, and this has cost him a mere $100 million, which I guess is proof that people will spend vast amounts of money on, like, weird objects. So maybe David Geffen is the person who will wind up buying Once Upon a Time in Shaolin. He's worth he's worth $6.9 billion. He can certainly afford it.
Yeah, it's like a, again, come back to the Egyptian thing. It's like a pharaoh putting his name on an obelisk and hoping that no one's ever going to wipe it off. So my number is 23. It's like the opposite of a nerdy number, but that's Michael Jordan's player's number. I'm bringing it up because...
Oh, it's a sexy billionaire!
Yeah, it's a sexy billionaire. Michael Jordan
is
now officially on the Forbes billionaire list. I still don't think anyone really wants the Michael Jordan of 2015 in a red room, but he is, I think, a fairly sexy billionaire. And I just wanted to mark this occasion. He's basketball's first billionaire. Magic Johnson jokingly tweeted asking to borrow some money. Everyone's having a good time with this.
Michael Jordan, yes. Okay, my number is 2063. How many people know what that is?
Is that the year?
It's a year. It's a year,
it's
yes.
It's the year. What happens in the year 2063? Are we all going to be underwater?
It's the year that the Vulcans make first contact with humans.
Yes. This is a sad number.
So this is R.I.P. Leonard Nimoy. Love that guy.
Leonard Nimoy, indeed.
On which sad note, we will bring this edition of Slate Money to an end. Thank you very much for listening all the way through. Do subscribe if you like the show. You can find us by searching for Slate Money in the iTunes store, where you can also leave a review. Would be wonderful if you did. And do keep on writing to us, slatemoney@slate.com. We really, really do love hearing from you, and we will talk about what you write on air. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but if you want it, we might.
We won't mock you.
We won't mock you.
Yeah.
Thanks very much to Audrey Quinn, who was the producer for Slate Money this week, and also the managing producer, Joel Meyer, and the executive producer, Andy Bowers. So Slate Money is part of the Panoply Network, so there's not just us. There's all manner of things from the New York Times and Inc. and you name it. Check out the entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. That's P-A-N-O-P-L-Y. Thank you.